Antonio Vieira and Antonio Vieira Law Group versus Rene Angel Hernandez and Noe Lauro Hernandez.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Corey Carlisle. I represent the appellants in this matter. The beneficiaries can't rewrite the will. That's where we stand. We have a case where there is an agreement. That's the first thing we have to show in an arbitration, in a situation where we're moving to compel arbitration, is an agreement. The second is a scope. So, of course, the standard of review that we're looking at it here, overarching everything, is that abuse of discretion standard. But of course, it's an abuse of discretion to not follow the law. And I think that the case law holds that more or less when we're looking at whether there is an agreement, we're looking at a de novo standard because we're interpreting a matter of law. And so that's where I think we are at this phase, de novo, more or less. So is there an agreement? Was there an agreement? The Supreme Court has adopted this area of law, direct benefits estoppel, you know, relatively recently in 2005 with the Kellogg, Brown, and Root, Weekly Holmes cases, and then further into the Raichaller versus Wrights, 2013. But in 2013, what the court said in the Raichaller case, actually, was that the legislature acted intentionally in choosing its words. It chose agreement, not contract. A broader term, as Williston and the treatises, everybody more or less agrees that this term is broader than contract.
Yeah, I don't think anyone disagrees that if, and there's so many names, if Renee and Noe were, well, Noe was the executor, but if they were complaining about, what are the other one's name? Roberto? I forget.
Joe.
No, not Renee. If they were complaining about someone else, some other beneficiary, then the direct benefits estoppel would apply.
And we wouldn't
I don't
be
think
here.
Anyone's arguing about that.
Right.
The question is whether Vieira Law Group is an interested person in a dispute arising out of the will.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And I think that part of the arbitration agreement is, as courts have said, extremely broad. It's broad as to scope and as to the types of people that it applies to. It doesn't apply to the people, you know, me. It doesn't apply necessarily to, you know, a stranger to the contract. However, this is the situation where I think when looking at the totality of our circumstances, they're telling. First off, the actions being sued over in this case against my client, those arose while he was the executor's lawyer. He's more or less at that time the executor. Without him, the executor would have issued the deed.
But he's not the executor.
He's counsel for the executor,
the dispute, surely. The dispute under the arbitration clause is defined as what's arising out of or appertaining to estate planning documents or the administration, distribution, and or settlement of the estate. All those things are done, the latter, are done by the executor himself, not the lawyer.
You know, I wonder if we're semantically just saying the same thing or different things, because I think I agree with that, Judge. I mean, the executor is the one who the will empowers to act. And it's the executor's duty to carry out the testator's intent. We are in this somewhat unique circumstance and where the executor hired a lawyer.
In fact, a lawyer that was somewhat directed by the testator in this case. It's in the same section of the will where they contemplate them hiring via the law group for the administration of the estate.
Yeah, I think they talk about being paid for. Are you referring to when they're being paid for preparing for any litigation on the back end?
Yeah, and that's another question I had was, would you characterize the lawsuit, the intervention by the two brothers into the probate case as a will contest? there's no doubt that there was the limiting instruction on the property in the will. And
yes,
and then they're trying to use that Uniform Heirs Partition Act
okay, yeah.
to subvert the testator's will. So I'm just curious, do you characterize that as a will contest?
You're talking about the companion case that's before
the companion
submitted
case.
Monday.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I feel like it's a side issue to this case, or maybe Your Honor thinks not.
If it's a will contest, then the VA, the law group, are certainly contemplated in that provision of the will.
Right. You know, they're
and any other successor lawyers.
I think that's right. They're definitely there's a fight about the meaning of the will, and so probably that means it's a will contest. That obviously has consequences, perhaps in as you know, the no contest clause and that sort of thing.
And to go back to what Justice Fonseca mentioned about it's the duty of the executor to execute those things. Yeah. Any dispute arising out of incident to the estate planning documents, et cetera, et cetera. But the executor or trustee or beneficiaries are specifically named in the will, and then they go on to say, and all other parties interested.
Right.
So who's that?
Well, that's where we think we fit in, because I learned in insurance law class back in law school, I used brackets and slashes, and then I circled the ors and the ands, and I think all other parties interested is a unitary phrase, and then I think or claiming an interest in my estate is another group of people. Back to what we're talking about, which I think is all other parties interested. You know, we're reading this like a contract. We have to give meaning to all the phrases. And so we already know that all of these other groups we're not talking about at this point. We're not talking about executor, trustee, beneficiary, purported beneficiary. And then I'm going to skip our phrase and go to the last one. Anybody who's claiming an interest. So maybe that's heirs of, you know, children of other beneficiaries. So what does all other parties interested mean in this matter? It seems to me that the lawyer for the executor fits under what is really, to me, kind of a catch-all.
But you also have to read that all other parties interested, you can scratch out or claiming an interest and say, and all other parties interested in my estate. So are they interested within the corpus of the state, the property, the money, the personal property, and does the representation of the executor mean he has an interest in the estate?
Yeah, I think interest is used in the word is used two slightly different ways between those two phrases. All other.
Well, I said remove or claiming an interest because or claiming an interest and right. Interested are two different things.
Yes. Okay. Well, then we agree.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. you know, and so that agreement, this, and I think a little bit we're talking scope, which is sort of who is bound by the clause at this point, which is more of a secondary term analysis here, the sort of the second phase of it. And at that point, when we're talking about if there is an agreement, then the court is deciding what does it cover, who does it cover, and it's at that point when we're at the second phase of scope, which I think we're talking about, where the courts uniformly, the Supreme Court tells us that we resolve doubts in favor of arbitration, and that's I think helps to, you know, that interpretive provision canon steps in there.
Doesn't the Texas Arbitration Act require mutual assent? And would you say there's mutual assent here?
In, I think we've cited this Fifth Circuit case, Brian, equitable estoppel, to conduct after the agreement. Okay, so the seeking and receiving benefits under the will version of direct benefits estoppel feels super long. The appellees here are beneficiaries. They're all deeded. Certain things, these requests are in there. It's very clear. Everybody's getting something. And it's also very clear, I think, that none of them have disclaimed their interest at all in any of these things. And so, by showing, by seeking, by receiving these benefits, even though they're fighting about what exactly it means, that is the mutual assent, Judge, that direct benefits estoppel steps in to show under Rachel, under the case we cite Collinsworth versus Swales, that sort of differentiates and deals that's how the court looks for it. With this unique circumstance where we're talking about a will and then we're trying to fit it into another doc. And I think that the Fort Worth Court did a good job of resolving that mutual assent issue that Your Honor asked about. And so there is, I believe, mutual assent which arises under the direct benefits estoppel theory by seeking and receiving benefits. Secondarily, as the Supreme Court has continued to recognize Taylor Morrison versus Hoff, G.T. Leach, at note 20.
But in this case, both parties are non-signatories to the agreement. And we can see how someone deriving a direct benefit from the will can't avoid the arbitration clause. But the question is, how does the non-signatory to it enforce the arbitration clause?
Sure. And, there's non-signatory cases where non-signatories can enforce. That's definitely been a concept that's been recognized over. There's a page on it, y'all. I believe in the Rachel case itself, there was a non-signatory. And that's if we don't find each of them in the clause we were talking about earlier, interested, all parties interested. Obviously, the beneficiary is interested. And then we get to that if we're not in that. There's the Rubiola case, Your Honor. It's another case where the non-signatory compelled arbitration. And the San Antonio case, it's Parrish & Company, 647, Delta 3rd, 469, 473. So it's happened.
But there was in those cases that you've cited, there was the successor enforcer, if you want to call him that, had some sort of interest in a contract with the other party, and even when there's another party that was a non-signatory as well, but they had some interest in it. And what interest does Mr. Vieira have that, or the law group have, that would enable him to enforce it?
Sure, I think that question speaks to where we're sitting in this unique posture of a will with an arbitration clause, and how quite do we deal with that? Because I think we're asking the court to resolve somewhat of an unresolved issue. The Supreme Court may get to before y'all issue any opinion, but I doubt that. And so the interest that I think that they
is there a case pending before the court now?
There's the Collinsworth versus Swales. Petition. There's a case that may speak to some of this. It's a Moncrief, Tex Moncrief's will, N. Ray Moncrief, 24-0956 and 0957. I don't talk about it. I just kind of talk a whole lot about Moncrief because they have a mess that's a multi-billion-dollar state, and there's lots of issues that don't necessarily touch it. It may end up helping a little bit. And it's say that in this bill, but I think that's part of good contract writing and good estate planning is to leave the words broad, to leave them able to be adapted to various circumstances. And so what interest does Vieta have, what interest do the appellants have in this circumstance? Well, they're being told that they interpreted a bequest incorrectly. And I think what you do is you look at the will and what does it say to determine the baseline that practice in this case. And so his interest is, well, I got it right. You know, I read this document. I think it says I don't have to put the partition language in there because that partition language is preceded by an if. So I don't include it. And I'm talking about Article 2. C. This is a record that the first appendix page 6. And so I think, you know, his interest is I got it. And that is innately ties him to this proceeding. And it makes him, in a way, interested in the outcome of the proceeding, interested in.
But wouldn't paragraph 2 of Article 10, in which it limits the reimbursement of costs and expenses to defending the contest of this will, it doesn't talk about a malpractice, doesn't talk about his wrongdoings. I mean, I would see that as limiting the scope of his interest in the will.
Okay. I think I would say it as this is talking about a different circumstance. I think I would see this as and I think it can make sense because, yeah, you get paid if you're fighting to defend, and if I can finish answering. You know, you get paid to help defend the contest to this will. But it seems like it would make sense if you know, the will is not on the hook for Vieta, you know, if he commits malpractice. The estate is not on the hook to pay him for his you know, reasonable cost and expenses to defend against, you know, alleged malpractice. I think if I was a testator, I wouldn't want to pay, you know, some lawyer alleged malpractice. Maybe he's right, maybe he's not. But that, I would see that as wasting you know, my assets and that I wanted to go to other people. And so for that reason, I think that's just enough of a different circumstance that it doesn't change what I have to say. So here's the court.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Medina, whenever you're ready.
Please, the court. I think that the Supreme Court tells us there's two phases here. There's the existence of an agreement, and the second phase is whether it falls into the court. They filed a motion to compel under 171.02. The trial court is tasked under the statute is to decide whether or not there's an agreement between the parties. 021 tells us if the court finds that there's not agreement, it denies the motion. The court denied the motion. So what was the evidence of the hearing and the motion to compel in our response? The only evidence that was presented was the will of Benito Hernandez. And the will of Benito Hernandez does not apply anywhere near the Vieta defendants because it applies, and it's very specific to it applies who are the parties, executor, beneficiaries, trustee, or anyone claiming an interest in the estate.
Well, it also says parties interested. And parties interested or claiming an interest are two different things.
Right. Agreed. Now, he falls outside that. This arbitration clause, the intent of the testator here, is disputes involving the estate, incident to the estate, because he doesn't want his family to be fighting. Now, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Texas Supreme Court in the Prescott case, what's the burden to prove the existence of an agreement to arbitrate? Well, the evidence needs to be clear and unmistakable evidence of an agreement. And it's got to be based on contract law, offer, acceptance, consideration. Now, he's talking as to some of the exceptions there, but there is no evidence of a written agreement to arbitrate between the appellees and the appellants. There is no evidence of a letter of engagement because he was the lawyer for the executor here that had an arbitration clause. He basically is a stranger to this arbitration agreement, and he cannot come in and step in and say, hey, I want to enforce that arbitration, because he's not a signatory, he's not a beneficiary, he's not a trustee.
Well, I think let's go back to all other parties interested, and then when you go farther down, it says any dispute arising out of incident to or otherwise pertaining to the estate planning documents. Definitely these were estate planning documents, and the lawyer's interpretation of the document. I'm not sure how hard he fought to keep that limiting language out, but it was his interpretation, and it was documents during the administration, distribution, settlement. So how's he not an interested party?
He's not an interested party just because he doesn't fall under the terms of the arbitration agreement. And on top of that, this arbitration agreement has to be applied to incident to the estate judge. If these arbitration clauses are not designed to shield lawyers from malpractice. The allegations against him in this case is he breaches fiduciary duty, failed to convey a settlement offer, changed discovery questions during litigation. Those are the allegations against him. The testator never had an intent to shield, you know, whatever lawyer he hired to assist the executor to administer the estate to defend him from legal malpractice. If that were the case, they would have written it into the document, you know.
And I'm going to ask you the same question as I asked Mr. Carlisle,
yes.
Do you think that the, or would you characterize the dispute as a will contest?
No. The dispute between
Mr. Orvieta Law Group and Noe and Renee, but the dispute between the other two brothers and Renee and Noe, for that matter. The fact that there was, they left out the limiting language.
Yes.
Because definitely that language was in the will.
Right.
And then for some reason or another, it didn't get recorded that way.
Right.
And now the two brothers want equal share of that property instead of not that east side of 390.
And I was involved in that case, because I still am involved, and that's over there. They filed that partition action based on property having left the estate, so therefore that limited language no longer applies. So, yeah, I think that's a pending for appeal there. But there's the pleadings, the existing pleadings right now between the executor, my client, against him, and against the two brothers also involved. The no contest clause also involved those other issues.
Okay.
Aren't we supposed to be reading this broadly? I mean, isn't the case law support saying we take a broad look at the arbitration clause? And isn't this an issue that's ultimately should be the whether or not it should be arbitrated or not is an issue for the arbiter?
Nowhere in that arbitration clause does it mention, and I want my attorney who doesn't do his job or allegedly doesn't do his job to also not be held responsible for his professional conduct. Judge, just think of the public policy ramifications if we allow a lawyer who's getting paid for his professional service to go ahead and participate in an arbitration clause to alleviate his liability from his legal profession.
But don't they do that all the time in engagement letters and other things?
Exactly, Judge. But
they drafted them.
There is no evidence before this court or before Judge Garcia that there was an engagement letter. There's no evidence.
I know not between them, but I'm saying lawyers write contracts with between them and their clients and put arbitration clauses in it all the time.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And but at that point, the client enters into the agreement knowing that if I have a dispute with my lawyer, we're going to go arbitrate.
So let's just, you know, for argument's sake, then who is all other parties interested in my estate?
Well, it could be anybody showing an interest, Judge. If it could have had a child that we didn't know about. I mean, there's just so many scenarios. But to apply incident to his estate and his probate documents to a lawyer for his professional conduct is just way out of the realm of what the whole purpose of arbitration clause is and what they're designed to do. I think Judge Garcia here was simply tasked under 171.021 is, is there an agreement between the parties? There's no writings. There's no direct benefit on there. The Supreme Court tells us you have to have an existence before we cross the bridge to scope whether or not the claims are covered. So it's a two-phase step here. We end at the existence. There's no writing. Didn't put on any evidence of providing engagement letter, a direct benefit, any evidence that they're an interested party in this estate at all. The only evidence that was presented by us, which is the will of the Negro Amendment, that clearly states who the policy is. And the other just simply isn't a part of that. So we ask the court to affirm Judge Garcia's denial of the motion. Is there any further questions of the court? Other than that, I'm going to give it back.
You going to give it back? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Medina. You got 3 minutes.
A couple quick points. I'd like to distinguish a case, Ollie versus Smith, that was in the briefs, that said no to arbitration in a somewhat similar circumstance. That case involved an administrator instead of an executive. And the court, the Houston court in Ollie was very, very careful in 761, 62, 63, that opinion to say administrators' duties, powers, they come out of the therefore, they made a very good distinction in that case, and I think drove their holding, in fact, is a crucial part of the opinion as to saying no to arbitration there, and I think that's why Ollie doesn't necessarily change my analysis. I think Ollie would say the will as a source of the power here means something. And also that the benefits that administrator sought in that case were fees. That was the allegation for direct benefits. To stop all this administrator's gave fees. The court said, by statute. And so the will giving the power to the executive here makes a difference in the way all would come out under Carfax. Another case why I love doing this, it's a 1944 case out of Dallas, Mason and Mason. In that case, they talked about probate court jurisdiction. And this goes to, they said there's claims by an executor against a lawyer named in the will. The executor, they had a falling out. And they say that the claims against the estate's lawyer appertained to will. This is old language in the probate code, jurisdictional language. The estate's code now, chapter 31 or 32, I'm sorry, it's one of the very first sections. It changed appertained to and incident to related to. So anyways, old case saying malpractice, these claims against the lawyers go towards the appertaining to. And finally, arbitration is a widely recognized dispute resolution way to corroborate cases. I think characterizations suggesting that a client is trying to hide or avoid responsibility are not supported in any Texas law. We ask the court to reverse. Thank you very much.
Okay, this case will be under submission. Thank you all very much.